It's Tuned to Yesterday with an hour of Collection Curios. I'm Mark Levonier. The old-time radio collection at WRVO Public Media, known as the Ellen Robinson Memorial Library, contains tens of thousands of broadcasts on reel-to-reel tape. There's a vast archive of the big-name shows from radio's golden age, but among the shelves are series with very few surviving episodes, one-off programs, underheard tapes, and long considered to be rare broadcasts. In this hour, we get the reel spinning with programs not yet heard on our show, or at the very least, on the air in a very long time. Later in this hour, one of radio's best-known advisors on marriage, John J. Anthony, a unique game show for the expectant bride called Your Hope Chest, but first, a brief moment with Art Baker's Notebook. In the 1930s, Baker was on the air quite a bit as host for several different West Coast shows, like the interview program Hollywood in Person and the audience-based show Reunion of the States. And after going national as the commercial announcer on Bob Hope's popular program, he was picked to host a game show that would have an astronomical rise on radio with and without him. In 1942, he was at the helm for about the next year and a half on the nationally broadcast Pull Over Neighbor, which was an audience stunt show for prizes that gave radio's Truth or Consequences a run for its money. In late 1943, he sadly had his contract broken, and the show became the Art Linkletter-hosted program People Are Funny, which made its own history. Throughout Baker's radio career, from time to time, he would record brief musings that would be played on stations for occasional color. Because he was such a familiar voice, these endured on the air at random for close to 20 years. Here's an episode now of Art Baker's Notebook from July 1st, 1947.
Hard from the mailbag I got a boot out of. Says, I've often wondered what you look like, but was afraid to find out. Why? Well, I thought, in fact, I was almost sure that you would have a drooping mustache. Just the thought of a mustache waving in the breeze as you spoke would have turned me against your delightful program. Now I can listen with added interest since I found out that you don't have a mustache. Hooray for Baker. Yes, I saw you in a picture, sincerely, and it was signed. I get a kick out of a postcard. For one penny, you can get more stuff on it. I'm very happy to know that the lady is happy. Fact is, there was only one occasion in my life when I gave in to the urge to raise a mustache. It didn't do as much for me as I'd imagined that it would. After about 3 weeks, I shaved it off. I don't think anybody ever noticed the experiment but me. I'm now patiently biding my time until fashion dictates that a mustache should be worn just under the lower lip, and then I may try it again. For some fantastic reason, I seem to have a better crop in that particular area. Well, aside from the subtle flattery of that card, which I should rightfully pass along to Mr. Gillette, it brings up an interesting point in the study of politics. Say, tell me, just how much influence does a mustache bring to bear on a ballot box, do you suppose? How many folks, for instance, would incline toward Governor Dewey because they think his mustache is cute? And how many folks are instinctively turned away because of that upper lip adornment? Well, this, you know, is one of the questions upon which a politician cannot equivocate. There's no fence straddling on that thing. He can't very well have a mustache on one side of his face and be clean-shaven on the other. And even if he could, there'd be no way of knowing exactly which way to turn, which side what. It isn't like speech-making, where you can alter the evidence to meet the immediate situation. Fellow workers, fellow farmers, fellow businessmen, depending upon who is invited to the banquet. A candidate must be either clean-shaven or he must have his mustache. It's got to be one or the other. I don't suppose that many folks in these United States would consciously be influenced by such a little thing. I don't imagine that many have said to themselves, I'm going to vote for Tom Dewey because I think his mustache would look cute in the White House. Nor do I suppose many have insisted I'm going to vote against him because I can't stand that little black soup strainer. After all, there are probably much larger issues involved in a presidential election. But how trivial are the things that can influence major decisions, do you suppose? How easily can we find fault with the man who doesn't instinctively appeal to us? And how easily can we find virtues to justify and glorify the man who has won our admiration? I don't know how you'd go about measuring such things, but I would imagine you would find a whale of a lot of history tied up with things no more significant than a little black mustache. What if Queen Isabella had taken one look at Chris Columbus and shuddered a bit and exclaimed, I can't stand the looks of that man. He looks like a crook. Do you suppose then that she'd have hocked her jewels to buy him some boats? Suppose Mary Ball had taken one look at Augustine Washington and decidedly loathed him. Then who would have been her son, the father of our country? And whatever would have happened to the cherry tree? I wouldn't be surprised if one of the more crucial and unequivocal problems a politician ever faces is whether or not to shave the upper lip. It probably has a greater indirect effect upon more people than whether or not he plans to trim the federal budget. I don't know how I could prove that, but neither do I know how you could prove that I'm wrong. So we'll look for the next item in the notebook.
A syndicated recording of Art Baker's notebook from the 1st of July, 1947. Next, on this hour of Collection Curios on Tuned to Yesterday, a program that was only heard on CBS West Coast stations in the era where the audience participation show was heading to its peak, with programs I mentioned earlier on the national level and many interesting variations. On radio's Your Hope Chest, five audience members would vote on the best romantic story of several soon-to-be-married couples who told it on stage and would be showered in prizes. A simple premise that drew nearly 7 million listeners a week on the CBS Pacific Network on Sunday evenings. And this broadcast, from what I could tell, is actually quite rare. So enjoy this hidden piece of history as heard live on October 12th, 1947.
Yes, love makes the world go round and round. So listen to the story of the little girl who dreamed of love until her dream man walked into her life. The man who was too big for everything but love. The grounds in the coffee that were grounds for marriage. The twice-told tale of love. Seven little steps to happiness. Yes, they're all on Your Hope Chest, the program that's filled with romance, the laughter, the dreams and plans of loving couples who are soon to be married. And now, here is your master of matrimonies, everybody's best man, Harry Von Zell.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Bob, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, this is Cupid's favorite bumpkin. And we have four very exciting love stories that you'll hear told by the very people who live them. And they will, of course, receive lots of beautiful gifts from Your Hope Chest. But one pair of lucky lovers will be selected as Cupid's couple by judges picked from our studio audience. And they will receive a hope chest overflowing with prizes and surprises. Now, Bob Lamont, let's have our first love story.
All right, Harry. He says she's little, but she's mighty. Now, she doesn't look so little. She's 5 feet, 5 inches tall, pretty, with dark hair and eyes. But now, let's look at him. Wow! No wonder he says she's little. He's 7 feet. Seven, that is. 7 feet and 1 inch above floor level. And here is how they fell in love. Lois Ludlow and Julius Johnson.
Is it cloudy down there to where you are?
Well, Julius, I hope that getting down to that microphone won't give you the bends. By George, you can do it on your knees, can't you? Well, Lois and Julius, it's awfully nice to have you on our hope chest. How did you two people happen to become interested in each other? Where did you first meet?
Well, Julius was my boss at Lockheed, Harry.
You were both working at Lockheed during the war, I presume?
Yes.
And he was your boss?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I see.
Being partial, I couldn't very well ask her to date because it would be showing partiality to other employees.
That's right. You were sort of on the spot. You'd get her in trouble by asking her for... Well, how did you manage to finally get together?
Oh, it was a year afterwards before he even asked me for a date. I think there was some six-foot competition in that.
Oh, I see.
Being from Oklahoma, I sort of like to take things slowly anyway.
I don't know that they take things so slowly in Oklahoma. Incidentally, Julius, you belong to the Tip Toppers?
I was a charter member and the tallest member, but marrying a girl under the 6 feet requirements, I'll probably be kicked out.
Oh, I didn't know. It's one of the rules that you have to marry someone over 6 feet. I didn't know that.
To be an active member.
What a terrific sacrifice. Well, it shows how much he cares for you, Lois. Well, is your height has any, is it any drawback to your romance at all? Have you found any trouble?
Not yet.
No trouble. How about you, Lois?
Well, we have had to change a few things, the chandeliers. We couldn't quite miss them.
Oh,
Well, you should have seen my head. It was a bruised and bloody mess.
You think his head should be a bloody mess? You should have seen me the first time he kissed me.
Why?
He was demonstrating.
Well, why? What happened, Lois?
He hit my head on the top of the door.
No.
And it sort of knocked me out, and as I fell, I knocked my hip out of joint, and he had to get me to the doctor.
Well, Julius, I would say you boys from Oklahoma not only believe in taking slow and easy, but you're sort of violent. He was demonstrating here just a moment when he picked Lois up and kissed her. You can bring her right up there to your level, can't you?
That's right.
Well, now, let me see. How about your families? Are all the folks in your family tall, Julius?
Well, I had a granddad that was 7'3" and a grandmother that was 6'2". There's one shorty in the family, is Uncle Paul. He was 6'11". I reckon that's how we'll probably have some tall young'uns.
Well, I certainly hope that you do, and I certainly hope that you'll be very, very happy together. And we're going to look into your hope chest here and see what we can do to add a little to that happiness. First of all, we find a lovely brass planter's lamp from the Valley Market Town. Isn't that a beauty? Now, I don't know whether you'll fit in this or not, Julius, but maybe we can arrange an extension if it doesn't work right. But here is a beautiful a piece to relax and rest in, a wonderful Phoenix Air float chair.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, sir, that Phoenix floating chair is cushioned with air foam rubber, just like sitting on a cloud. And now, Lois, look here. From Virtue Chrome comes this handsome five-piece Virtue Chrome extension dinette set. Complete set. The chair's in red leatherette, the table is adjustable and stain-proof. And that's not all. Here from the California Music Company, in this hand-finished mahogany cabinet, is your new General Electric radio and phonograph combination. Thank you very much, Lois, Julius. Good luck to you.
Harry?
Yeah?
Do you believe in dreams?
Do I believe in dreams? Bob, to tell you, I'm noncommittal on the question, really. Why?
Well, after you hear our next story, I think you will. Because after dreaming the same dream for years, Sally Ann Wedge is going to wake up at the altar, exchanging vows with her dream man, Alfred Lathrop.
Well, this we have to hear it all. Sally Ann, do you mind if I say you're not a bad dream yourself?
Thank you.
You don't mind my saying that, do you, Al?
Not at all.
I presume you agree with me.
Oh, yes.
Well, what is this business about all these dreams and coming true and whatnot, Sally Ann? How did it happen?
Well, I used to swim out at Pickwick Swim Pool all the time, and I was 11 years old, and he was a handsome lifeguard there.
Oh, I see. How old was he at the time?
Oh, I was 16.
Oh, you were getting along in years.
Oh, yeah, quite a few.
And Sally Ann was only 11. Well, you, I presume, then worshipped him from afar, did you,
Sally? Oh, yes, I just worshipped him, and I dreamt about him all the time. I made believe I knew him. And I...
You should be proud of it, Al.
Flattered, anyway.
And all my dreams, and I dreamed that he was take me dancing, and he was awfully sweet, even if I didn't know him. In some of the dreams, I was even married to him.
Is that so? Well, you really did have it bad, didn't you, Sally? And I suppose... What'd you say, Al?
Told her to stop shaking.
No point in stopping shaking. I shake all the time, too. Well, how did you... with all this dreaming, did you take your mother into your conversation about it? Huh?
Yes, I took her into it. I'd tell her about the good-looking lifeguard. All the sympathy I ever got was she'd tease me and tell me I was awfully young.
Well, of course you were, but I imagine even at that age you could suffer, couldn't you?
Yes, I suffered, and I'd cry about it, but I dreamt anyway.
You had your dream.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how about you? How was your dream life about this time, Al? What were you dreaming of anyone in particular?
No, I was playing the field.
Just playing the field and sleeping soundly with no dreams at all.
That's right.
Well, how did you finally manage to attract him, Sally?
Well, he used to play ping pong with the boy next door, so I saw him a lot.
Oh, and you finally met him through that...
No, not yet.
Oh, not yet. Well, what happened?
Well, he's playing ping pong. I'd sit and I'd watch him through the window so they couldn't see me. And then my mother would come along and tease me when she'd catch me. It was really very heartbreaking.
Suffer some more.
Yes. But the crowning blow came one day when she came home and told me my lifeguard was engaged to a woman, an old woman. Gosh, she was 17 years old.
Oh, no. 17 was pretty old, wasn't it, Al?
Well, not so bad. I was 18.
Yeah, well, of course. You and you, of course, hadn't even met Sally Ann. So
no, not yet.
There was really no triangle created here at all. Mm-hmm. Well, now what developed from this? How long were you engaged to this, shall we say, older woman?
Oh, I'd say about 2.5 years.
what happened to bring an end to that?
Well, I went in the service, and when I came back, we just didn't see things the same light.
Oh, I see. How long were you away?
Oh, about 2.5 years.
2.5 years. And coming back from the service, did you arrange to run into him, or did you just happen to meet again by accident?
It was all purely by coincidence at a party.
A girl's party.
And all of a sudden, let's see, you had then reached the ripe old age of...
17.
See, you'd caught up with this other woman finally.
Yeah, I caught up with the old woman.
Well, and now that you've won, Al, Sally Ann, tell me, does your mother still tease you about your dreams?
No, she doesn't tease me anymore. Just every once in a while, she'll look at me and she'll say, see, Sally, dreams do come true.
You bet they do. And anyone who stops dreaming is going to miss an awful lot, believe me. Well, kid, we'll look in this hope chest here and see what we have for you. To save time, Sally Ann, when you cook for that man of your dreams there, here is a handy Presto pressure cooker. Believe me, that'll save you an awful lot of time and trouble. And next, for a perfect brew of coffee, this universal electric percolator. And now designed, there's more still, designed for top performance, engineered for safety and efficiency. And we knew you'd need it, and here it is, your new universal electric washing machine. Thank you very much, kid. Best of luck to both of you.
And now, Harry, here is today's letter of love from our listening audience. To your hope chest, from Mrs. Raymond Alsop, Route 4, 496 Monterey Road, Salinas, California.
And the letter reads as follows. Dear Hope Chest, 7 babies ago, I reserved a place in my heart for our Navy, for I met my husband in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Today, almost 17 years later, we are no longer a gob and a gal, but mom and pop to 7 high chair to high school age youngsters. We met while he was on escort duty, and he took my mother, my sisters, and me on a tour of the USS Texas, which was then flagship of the fleet. Because he was so far from home, he's one of those rarities out here, a California native, mother invited him to dinner the next evening, and living up to the Navy tradition of being a fast worker, he popped the question, and we became Mr. and Mrs. in about 8 weeks' time. 6 months later, he received his discharge out here in the Golden State. And with the Stork as our star boarder, there has never been time nor opportunity for the honeymoon we never had. Nor have I ever been back to Brooklyn. Of course, if I had it to do all over again, I would go ahead and choose my family. For even with all the ills, chills, and bills, being a mother is wonderful. We've gone through some heartbreaking experiences, but we went through them together and came out smiling. When he leaves his clothes on the floor or brings mud in on a rug I've just swept by the old elbow grease method, I feel very martyred. But when I put that alongside his good points, all his seeming carelessness fades into insignificance, and I realize how lucky I am. All this, and 7-2. Sincerely, Mrs. Raymond Alsop. Well, if you'll pardon the play on words, that was a 7-cent letter, Mrs. Alsop. Really a wonderful letter. And needless to say, we think mothers are wonderful, too. But now again, ladies and gentlemen, our love letter comes to life because we are sending Mr. and Mrs. Alsop on their first and second honeymoon. But first, for their home up there in Salinas, here is a fine-toned Gil Fillon radio and a lovely mahogany cabinet. And now, Mr. and Mrs. Alsop, here is Bob Lamont to tell you about your second honeymoon.
Mr. and Mrs. Alsop, when you hear flight call 11, you'll step aboard a huge four-engine Western Airlines Skymaster plane that will take you on a thrilling flight to colorful La Jolla, the jewel of the Pacific. And there you will be whisked away to one of the loveliest hotels in the West, magnificent Hotel La Valencia, for your second honeymoon. Amid all this luxury and tropical beauty, you may dine in the patio of the famed garden restaurant. You will enjoy the authentic Parisian atmosphere of Café La Rue, where the finest foods are prepared before your very eyes. And, too, there's a bridal suite that's waiting just for you. Then, after the fun and romance of your expense-free second honeymoon at Hotel La Valencia, you will be flown back home on a sleek Western airliner smoothly and safely. So happy landings and happy second honeymoon. Well, this next love story, Harry, is going to write happy beginning to a love that had an unhappy ending back in 1942. And here to tell us are Zelda Allen and her fiancé, William Allen.
Well, good. Zelda and Bill, you step right up here to our Hope Chest microphone. I'm curious about Bob's introduction. He says, we're going to write a happy beginning to a love that had an unhappy ending in 19... What happened in 1942?
We were divorced in 1942.
You were divorced in... then you've been married before.
Yeah.
To each other.
We met and fell in love when she was...
Well, now let's hear this. When did you first meet?
We met and fell in love when she was 15 and I was 17.
This was back in 1942... And
1938.
Oh, 1938, when you were first...
When we first met.
When you first met, I see. And, how about... What did your family have to say about this arrangement? You're very tender age to be thinking of marriage.
Well, we wanted to go steady, but our parents thought we were awfully young, so we eloped.
Oh, I see. Well, you started your romance really early, didn't you? Well, now, what brought about the trouble?
Oh, we were just young and in love, and we got jealous of each other and of things, and we were just too young to face the trials and tribulations of marriage, even though we have two children, two little girls.
Is that so? Well, you at that age, I suppose little things were big issues, and you'd get to fussing about them.
Quite a bit.
We'd fight all the time, and neither one of us would give in to the other.
Both of you have a stubborn streak, huh? Or did have. Well, now, after your divorce in 1942, did you lose track of each other completely then?
Yes, I went into the Navy and was gone 4 years. And I thought it all over, and I realized what a fool I had been, and I knew I wanted my wife and my children.
Oh, I see. And what were you doing at the time?
Well, I went to work to support the children. I was a grease monkey in a gas station.
A grease monkey in a gas station, is that so? Well, how did you happen to find Zelda when you returned from service?
Well, when I came back 4 years later, I found her in the gas station, grease all over her face, and her hair was stringy. It didn't matter, though. I was grown up, and I realized that I loved her very much.
You had time to think things over.
Yeah.
Well, how did you feel when you saw Bill again?
Well, I was grown up, too, by that time, and I just realized that... it was best to swallow my pride. So at that time, we started to go around together just as a couple, just as a fella and girl, not steady dating. And each had a chance to go out, but we just didn't work that way.
Just didn't feel like going out with anybody else for some reason or other. And so you decided to remarry, huh?
Well, we were sort of forced into it. Our eldest daughter went to school one day, and she wrote on a paper, I wished my father would marry my mother.
Oh, my I can see we're not having a chance to explain. That could be a little embarrassing.
It got to be quite embarrassing, but we thought it was a pretty good idea, and so we just decided that we were both grown up enough now and that we could handle it.
Well, I think this is one of the most wonderful love stories we've had on Hope Chest. And I don't think that there's any doubt but what you two will be two of the happiest people in this world from now on. Really, I do. But see if we can add a little bit to this happiness. That's right, go ahead. Now, let me see. First of all, here for both of you, I think both of you will find this handy. Complete with accessories, America's first post-war vacuum cleaner, the Compact. It's an easy one to store and to carry, ensures your lifetime wear. And now, here for these little jobs around the house that are so tiring, you can find this will be very helpful to you. The magic way to iron. We have for you a Thor Automagic Glad Iron. Your Thor Glad Iron irons everything faster and safer, and you can sit down and watch its automatic. Good luck to both of you, and thank you for coming. Now, Bob, let's take a moment here. I just ran out to get a soda, you know, here. Bob, I think it would be a good idea to remind our listeners that any engaged couple is eligible to appear on this program.
All right, Harry. Any of you folks listening who are planning to be married in the near future, why don't you call or write to Your Hope Chest, Columbia Square, Hollywood 28, California.
Good idea.
You've heard the oft-used expression, Harry, time heals all wounds.
Yeah.
Well, in the case of Jason Gale, his meeting with the airline stewardess Paula Betts was a very unhappy experience. But thanks to Father Time, Brother Cupid, and perhaps Mother Necessity, everything worked out fine. And here they are to tell us all about it. Jason Gale and Paula Betts.
Good. Jason and Paula, we seem to have quite a complicated setup here. Bob gave billing to Father Time, Brother Cupid. I have all the letters. You just put them in the right order and some words will come up. And also Mother Necessity was mentioned. Now, this seems to be an unusual case. Would you begin and tell us how this all came about?
Well, it all started on an airplane.
Oh-ho.
You know, Paula was a stewardess. And during the war, I was based in Chicago. And I was going to fly back there from Los Angeles.
I see.
So I took off and in the DC-4, and Paula was my stewardess. So I went to sleep on the way back and was having what I thought was a very nice snooze up there in the seat. And in the meantime, Paula had begun to serve coffee to the passengers. And, of course, I was asleep by now, and wasn't aware of this just yet. But all of a sudden, I was awakened by this deluge of hot, steaming coffee rolling all over me and my uniform.
Oh, no, so, you didn't pour it on him.
Yes, I poured it on him.
On purpose?
No.
Oh, little lurch
exactly.
Of the plane, and it just...
Yes.
You didn't resent his sleeping by any chance, did you?
Well, I... kind of had my eye on him, but I...
You didn't pour the coffee on him on purpose.
No.
Well, this was a rude awakening, I'd say.
Oh, yes. Well, I thought at the time that I would have been much better if I just got myself a bunk out on the wing, you know, and flown that way.
Probably have been safer out there.
But I didn't... I was very annoyed,
naturally.
I guess, because that was the only uniform that I had. It was a brand new one, and I didn't have another one. So I had to report to my commanding officer the next morning.
With the soiled uniform?
With the soiled uniform,
oh,
yes.
Oh, dear. What happened?
Well, I walked into the room and saluted. The colonel saluted me back and as if it were very routine. And then he caught sight of no press from about here down, you know, and splotches along here. He said, where have you been? And I said, well, I'm returning from leave, sir. He said, well, maybe I better give you another 30 days.
He said, what?
Maybe I better give you another 30 days. So he said, well, we can't have you running around the streets of Chicago like this. Do you have any clean uniform? And I said, no, I didn't have any more. And I explained the situation to him, that I had had coffee spilled on me on the way by plane.
By a careless young stewardess.
I elaborated on that rather well.
Yes, that's you.
So I was confined to barracks for until the rest of my clothing got there, which had come by a different method of transportation.
Would it be safe to ask you what your views on Paula were about this time?
Right, way down. Yes, sir.
He was in the very small doghouse, the one at the end of the line.
That's right.
Well, now, How did you happen to run into Paula again? Did you after your confinement was finished? Did you look her up just to bawl her out or something?
Well, for a while I was quite incensed, and I was going to be very irate about it. I guess I wasn't. I was acting rather pettily. Mm-hmm. I was going to try to check on her through the company and everything, but as I said, my commanding officer confined me to the barracks, so I cooled off by the time my uniforms
got
there.
Yeah, had time to think it over.
So I went ahead and stayed in Chicago, and eventually, of course, I was released from the service. And about a year later, I was coming back out to Los Angeles to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stopped at Salt Lake to change planes, and
I've
never
I
quite forgotten.
Yes,
there.
Yeah, I think you ought to get a word in here, Ed.
I'm talking a bit.
Well, now, you take it from there, Paula. He just happened to get on the plane in which you were assigned at the time.
That's right. It was quite unusual because we have 100 girls. But anyway, he moaned and he said, "Oh, no, not you again." I said, "Yes, me again." So on the way back, I asked him if he'd like a cup of coffee, and he said no. He thought he'd have milk this time. So we made our journey home, and he asked me at that time if I might go out with him sometime, and that he wasn't angry with me any longer, and I said, yes, I would like to go out with him. And then, see, from there...
From there, things started happening, I suppose.
That's right. But I loved my work very much, and I would like him very much, but decided that I liked the air, too. And so he stopped dating me for a while, and he resumed his studies. And so finally, I was very discouraged about it. And he said, on our last date, he said, "You either have to take the airplane or me." And so I said, "Well, it'll be you," and so I'm grounded for the duration.
I don't think you'll mind it a bit. Really, I don't, Paula. I think you'll enjoy it, as a matter of fact. And you'll find that keeping house with a husband is much better than with an airplane, believe me. I know being up in the air does something to you. I'm up in the air most of the time, so... But we'll see if we can start your honeymoon kitchen off right. You've hit the jackpot here. A streamlined four-burner Western Holly gas stove, Paula. Equipped with warming oven, broiler, oversized oven, three-hour timer, electric clock, and right on top of that glistening white Western Holly stove, a complete set, seven pieces of the finest aluminum cookware. Royal Chef. Thank you, and good luck to you. Well, we've heard all the stories for today, and now comes that exciting moment.
Hear ye, the chancellors of Cupid's court are about to reach their decision.
Yes, sir, the five judges selected from our studio audience are choosing Cupid's couple for today.
But first, Harry, before we reveal the winner, let's lift the lid off that oversized hope chest and see what we have in store for that lucky couple.
Good idea. First, for both the lucky lovers, here is a beautiful 17-jewel Bulova wristwatch. There they are, aren't they beauties?
Yes, sir, and just look at this lucky forever matched engagement and wedding ring set. Studded with beautifully matched diamonds, this Lucky Forever set was designed by the world-famous Allison Kaufman Company.
Now, just to keep their love warm, here is a lovely St. Mary's blanket of character. Isn't that a nice one?
And with it comes one half dozen, six, that is, of the finest Lady Pepperell double-sized sheets.
Sure enough. Now, a very handy little item, the Proctor Never Lift Iron, with the spring stand so designed that you never have to lift it while ironing.
And next, a lovely Wilbury lace tablecloth.
Yeah, that's nice, but the honeymooners must have luggage, Bob. So here from your Rexall druggist is this handsome matched set of airplane luggage.
And here's something more for the kitchen, Harry. For a happy breakfast and happy groom, this shining chrome-finished automatic waffle baker. But, Harry, everybody's waiting to hear who is our Cupid's couple.
The judges have handed in their secret ballots, Bob, and they have selected couple number three, Zelda Allen and William Allen. Zelda and Bill, the couple who parted only to be reunited and are more in love than ever, I'm sure. You feel happy about this whole thing, kids?
Very much so.
Well, I should think you would, and believe me, we're very happy for you. But now we have one more gift for you, and we think it's the sweetest gift of all. We hope you agree. Your honeymoon. Nestled in the beautiful wooded mountains of Northern California and located at the site of the famed Richardson Mineral Springs is the Richardson Springs Hotel. And here in the breathtaking beauty of spreading oaks, towering pines, and meadows covered with wildflowers, you can bathe in the sparkling waters of the Crystal Plunge, ride in the pine-scented trails of Bidwell Park, fish in the lakes and streams nearby, or explore historic Indian caves if you wish. And you will find the spacious Richardson Springs Hotel ready to live up to its well-deserved reputation for the ultimate in comfort, the finest in food. And all this, we hope, will combine to make your expense-free honeymoon a cherished memory for all those happy years together. Good luck and God bless both of you.
Your Hope Chest came to you from Hollywood. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Your Hope Chest from the 12th of October, 1947 on the CBS Pacific Network. The show happened to be laterally involved in a scandal that month where a couple who had won an all-expenses-paid wedding and prizes on the rival Bride and Groom program were heard on Your Hope Chest the night before with their winning story, which won them the suite of prizes, disqualifying them from their winnings on Bride and Groom. When asked about the couple's lawsuit for about $250,000 in damages in today's money, Bride and Groom show producer John Reddy was quoted in Time magazine saying, "Sure, we kicked him off." This is an hour of collection curios on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm Mark Levonier. Now on to our last broadcast, which directly confronts rather than rewards marital stories. Lester Kroll, whose story would take another program to tell, had his sights in the 1920s on helping married couples after his own rocky divorce, and after changing his name to John J. Anthony and drumming up a questionable resume that included him creating the Marital Relations Institute, took to the air in 1937 on Radio's Goodwill Hour in New York, going national in the same year. His weekly show would become an institution and a daily 15-minute program at the time of this next broadcast, where he interviewed and gave advice to anonymous guests in a style that was very much his own. Surprisingly, very few programs exist from his robust and popular 16-year run on the air, but here's one of them now, from April 14, 1945, from the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Is the sweetheart you married the husband you expected him to be? Has the war created new problems for you in your marriage? To answer these and other personal problems brought in by your friends and neighbors, ARID presents John J. Anthony, founder of the famed Marital Relations Institute, in a brand new program of daily sessions of kindly and helpful advice. Just as Mr. Anthony, by examples in this studio, is helping thousands of men and women solve their personal problems, ARID, too, is helping thousands to solve the important personal problem of underarm perspiration. ARID helps you avoid perspiration damage to clothes and safeguards friendships. ARID every day. It helps stop perspiration safely, and at the same time, ARID is a most effective deodorant. And now your friend and advisor, John J. Anthony, one of America's best-known counselors on human relations. By listening to Mr. Anthony's solution of the problems brought here by these people needing advice, perhaps you too can find happiness and contentment. It is with that thought in mind that these daily sessions were created. Mr. Anthony, are you ready for your first case?
Quite ready, George.
The first case is that of Miss C.A.
All right, Miss, your problem. Did you say Miss C.A., George?
C.A.
All right, thank you. Your problem, please. Come in.
About 2 years ago, I met and fell in love and...
Come in close, please.
I met, fell in love, and became deeply involved with a man who had been recently discharged from the Army. After much persuasion on my part, we were married, and we opened a home on my money.
Why did you have to persuade him? Didn't he want to get married?
He said he was in no position to marry.
When you say you became deeply involved, do I gather that to mean that it would have been exceedingly unwise for this man not to marry you?
Yes.
All right, go on, please.
For a while, things ran smoothly, and we got along very well with one another.
Uh-huh.
And when...
Oh, come now.
Up until the time I expected my baby, he asked me to live with my mother until the baby came.
He, too, lived with your mother?
No, he left.
Just you alone?
That's right. He lived at our apartment, and I went to live at my mother's.
He lived at your apartment, and you went to reside with your mother. Why?
He said that he was afraid to be left alone in the house with me if anything did happen.
Well, that's novel at any rate, but go on. Go ahead,
well,
please.
Well, after I gave birth to my baby, I moved near my mother because I was ill and needed her care.
Mm-hmm.
And then things were fine again. But then He came and told me that he had become deeply involved with another girl.
Aha, I see. That couldn't have been the reason that he might have wanted you to live with your mother while he remained at home.
I think it was the reason.
All right. Go on.
And he asked me to move in with my mother. And, I did move into my mother.
You've told me that. Was this the second time that you returned to your mother? After he became involved with this other person?
That's right.
I see. All right.
And when I asked him if he wanted a divorce, he said no, that the girl didn't mean anything to him, that he did want to stay with me and the baby.
Mm-hmm.
Then after a while, he said that he moved in with me the second time to my mother's.
I don't mean to be facetious at all, madam. Believe me. I'm not trying to be humorous. But this man used a marriage license to get married, didn't he? He didn't use a commutation ticket. I have heard thousands of these situations. This is the third or fourth time that you changed residence with and without your husband in a period of how long?
It was 2 years. It was the second time that I went to my mother with him.
Mm-hmm. All right, go on, please.
And he said that we moved in there against my advice. I knew that he couldn't live with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And then afterwards he told me that he felt very depressed and very unhappy.
About what?
About living with my mother.
I see. All right.
And he went back to his mother's house to live, and he still didn't ask me for any divorce.
Uh-huh.
And then I did a foolish thing. I went to the girl and asked her if she meant anything to my husband and whether or not she wanted to marry him.
Mm-hmm.
Said if she did, would she help me get my divorce?
I see.
And she told me that she wouldn't help me because she felt it was none of her business, what my husband and I decided to do.
I see.
Then I spoke to her father. I thought he might be able to persuade her to see things my way.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he didn't care whether or not I dragged his daughter to court because she wasn't any good.
That was the father's opinion of his own daughter. Mm-hmm.
Now, my problem is this. Shall I wait until he decides whether or not he wants a divorce or wants to come back, or shall I seek a divorce?
I see. In other words, he is, at this particular point in your life, he isn't living with you anymore, huh? Has your husband demanded a divorce, or does he still feel, as he did some time ago, that divorce was a relatively unimportant matter and that he would prefer to remain with you and the child? Now, what's his attitude at this moment?
He's asked me to leave him alone until he can decide one way or another.
I see. And you'd like me to tell you whether or not I believe you ought to give him that time or whether or not you ought to get a divorce, huh?
Yes.
How old are you?
21.
How old is your husband?
23.
23. Well, I am not going to recommend a divorce. However, I am not going to recommend that you live with him either. You see, you didn't marry a man of 21. You married a grown-up boy of 21. He is, he doesn't understand life. He doesn't know what marriage is. He only married you because very likely you threatened to cause some difficulty in his life. So it was the easiest thing for him to do, to marry you. He didn't think at that time that marriage carries with it social, economic, and other responsibilities. These responsibilities he has forgotten all about. Now, I don't think that he's going to awaken to them almost momentarily. He's not that kind of a man. Proof of that is his mode of living since he's married you. He became involved with another young woman. He does want a divorce. He doesn't want a divorce. He does want to live with you. He doesn't want to live with you. He's shuttled you between homes as though you were a chattel rather than a wife. I did say, though, that I don't recommend a divorce. I recommend you living apart from this man and having him support you and your child until such time as he has become sufficiently mature to know what a home is, what a wife is, and what a child is. Go ahead.
Well, he has been sending me $5 a week for the baby. I mean, I haven't taken him to court or anything like that
mm-hmm.
because his mother didn't want me to. She felt that I really did mean something to him and that he would come back eventually.
Mm-hmm. Well, wait until that time comes about. And when this prize package that you married I am not attempting to be sarcastic at all, but this man has an exaggerated opinion of his own value and his own worth, believe me. Not only that, but all the women in his life, including his wife. Of course, his mother, too, have an exaggerated idea of this man's value. It's untrue. There are other men, far more important men than this boy that you married. You stay away from him, and when he does finally make up his mind that he wants to come back to you, be very, very careful about taking him back. Make certain that he knows what marriage is. Make certain that he knows the responsibilities entailed in that marriage. And make sure that the love you think you now have for him still is in your heart.
Well, go on. Here's another part. You see, my mother-in-law wants to see the baby, and I have been bringing the baby to her weekends, but every time I go, he's been there, and we've ended up in an argument. So I don't know whether to continue bringing the baby to her or...
Yes, I think you want to bring the child to your in-law's home. As a matter of fact, if the quarrels between you and your husband, when you live there, become too severe, have your in-laws come to visit you if they want to see the child. Certainly, I would not deny the grandparents the right to see the child. I don't think that concerns your husband. I think it's only a human action on your part. I would do it if I were you. But don't take him back until you're certain that he's the kind of a man you had hoped he would be when you married him. Good luck to you. Friends, I'll take up the next problem in just a moment. But now I want you to listen closely to a problem that concerns all of us.
You know, friends, some women just don't...
Wait a minute, George. You're always going on about women, telling how they should use Arid and everything. How about men?
Well, how about them?
Well, I've heard of businessmen in offices who offend with the odor of underarm perspiration, and I've been near them in movies. After all, men are human, too. And you could very easily persuade them to get a jar of Arid if you tell them what an effective deodorant it is.
Right. Men, Arid is a snow-white, greaseless, and stainless antiseptic cream that safely helps stop underarm perspiration and odor. And Arid doesn't irritate the skin. It'll keep you from staining your shirt, and it'll keep you from offending others. More men and women use Arid than any other deodorant because it does its job so well. Arid is on sale at drugstores and department stores, and it's very inexpensive insurance for keeping clean and dry.
Very nice. So, men and women both, remember to use Arid cream deodorant daily. Buy the economical 39-cent jar. That's Arid, A-R-R-I-D.
And now, here is Mr. Anthony's next case.
Thank you, George. Friends, I have a letter that I'd like to read. It comes to me from Indiana, and it's signed Mrs. G.F. It says, I'm a widow and stay at home with my parents, who are both old. Father's 70, mother 65. I also have a son overseas for the past 18 months who is married and has a 15-month-old baby. 8 months ago, my daughter-in-law came over to the house, and my mother tried to tell her what to do about the running of her business. They had words, and now my daughter-in-law no longer comes to the house. Someone wrote my son about this, and he's terribly hurt to think that they don't speak. I'm good to my parents, also good to my son's wife, and have done everything possible to smooth this over. But my mother and daughter-in-law are both stubborn, and as a result, I'm torn from side to side. My mother is old and thinks I should take her part. But I can't do that, as I want to be fair with both, and I feel that since my son is overseas, he expects me to stick to his little family. I'd like to have your advice, the writer continues. What do you think it is best for me to do? I want to do the right thing by both of them. Well, madam, a great many people have the same sort of difficulties on occasion. Your difficulties are heightened by the fact that your son happens to be overseas at the moment. I don't think that is a question of siding with either your mother or your daughter-in-law. As a matter of fact, I don't see why they should quarrel about these things. Your daughter-in-law doesn't live with your mother, and she's going to run her life as she sees fit, and very likely she's not going to take direction from her grandmother. Insofar as you're concerned, I think you ought to be pleasant to both your daughter-in-law and your mother. Now, why either one of these women, the old woman of 65 and the youngster, should demand that you take sides is something that I don't understand. I think you ought to be kind to both. That's the wisest way to do things, and let your daughter-in-law run her life in her own way and not have mother interfere. Good luck to all of you. Friends, I'd like to help all of you listeners as I try to help the people that come here to the studio and those that write to me from all over the country. If you have a personal problem and need understanding and sympathetic guidance, these daily sessions have been created to fulfill that need. I think that we've been successful in helping thousands find greater happiness. Why don't you sit down now and write to me? State your problem in full detail and address it to John J. Anthony in care of the station to which you are now listening. Don't hesitate. I shall keep your name a confidential secret and never reveal your identity. And now here's something you should know about.
Waiter! Waiter! Bill, did you ever see such poor service? I'm going to call a manager.
Take it easy, Walt. What's mostly wrong is your grouch.
I'm sorry, Phil, but my digestion is so upset.
What you may need for your poor digestion is something that works after nature's own order. Try Carter's Little Liver Pill.
Good advice. When your digestion is upset and you feel headachy and irritable, take Carter's Little Liver Pill. You see, each day, nature normally produces about 2 pints of a vital digestive juice to help digest your food. If nature fails, your food may remain undigested, leaving you headachy and irritable. To feel cheerful and happy again, take Carter's Little Liver Pills. They increase the flow of this vital digestive juice quickly, often in as little as 30 minutes, and you're on the road to feeling better. Don't depend on artificial aids to counteract indigestion when Carter's Little Liver Pills aid digestion after nature's own order. Take Carter's Little Liver Pills as directed. Get them at any drugstore, only 25 cents. Join us tomorrow at this same time when we again present John J. Anthony, one of America's best-known counselors on human relations. George Putnam speaking.
The John J. Anthony program from the 14th of April, 1945 on Mutual Radio. And that's the last reel on this hour of mainly unscripted and real voices on this Collection Curios episode of Tuned to Yesterday. Be with us again for more unique shows from radio's golden age. I'm Mark LeVonier. Thanks for listening.